This is a recording of Laura Lyle from Bakersfield, California, taped at the Saturday night AA speaker meeting in Visalia, California on July 17th, 1990. In observance of our 11th tradition, please keep this tape within the fellowship and honor the anonymity of all our AA speakers.
Our main speaker, Earl from Bakersfield.
I'm Earl Lyle, I'm an alcoholic. My God, what a group of sick-looking people. I want to welcome the newcomers. If you're anything like I was when you came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I got to Alcoholics Anonymous if I didn't believe that I belonged here. But I do. I want to thank Don for giving me some kind of an introduction. I want to name a lot of people here tonight because I get a dollar for every time I mention somebody's name that's in the audience. He's getting his billfold out, so he's going to keep track, you know. I may mention Don P. Don W. now. He gave me the introduction, and Don P. is over here, and his wife, Ellen. I'm glad to see them tonight. I want to thank Bill L. for inviting me up here. He called me about a week or so ago, and he says, I hear you're the Pope of Alcoholics Anonymous in Bakersfield. I'm a little discouraged that you didn't introduce Don W. as the Pope of AA, because I understand over at the Alana Club here on Murray that he is the Pope. For those of you who don't know it, why, to refer to him as whatever you'd refer to the Pope as, I don't know. I'm going to tell you a story about the Pope, because I like to tell stories. The Pope called his chauffeur one day, and he said, I want to go for a ride. So the chauffeur brought the limousine around, and they headed out of town, and they just got out to the edge of town, and the Pope tapped him on the shoulder, and he says, do you mind if I drive this thing? He says, I've always wanted to drive this big limousine. And the chauffeur says, no, I don't care. So they traded places. And the Pope headed down the highway, and before long he was going 100 miles an hour. And the cop pulled him over, you know. And when he noticed who was driving, well, he called his supervisor back at headquarters, and he says, I just arrested a guy for speeding. And he says, I don't know what to do about it. And the guy says, well, you give him a ticket. He says, well, you don't understand. This guy is very important. He says, it doesn't matter. He says, he is very, very important. And the guy says, well, how important is he? He says, I don't know, but he's got the Pope for a chauffeur. That's about me, the same as me being Pope of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've met a lot of people here tonight. Mike came up and introduced himself. He didn't need to introduce himself. I know him. And another beautiful lady came up to me and said, do you remember me? And I said, I sure do know you. You're Susie. Susie came in with grass. You know, it's a pleasure for me to be able to travel around in Southern California and speak at meetings like this as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And see, the real benefit is that I get to stay sober, and I get to see a lot of friends that I've met in this program that I don't get to see on a regular basis. Mike Kay and I are very, very close, and Carolyn and I are pretty close, and These things mean a lot to me. So if you're new in the program Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, sobriety is wonderful and it's great, but the fellowship is a tremendous, tremendous thing too. There's nothing in the world that I could even imagine better for me than the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Don mentioned I took up golf. I'm going to tell you a golfing story. Well, I'm going to talk about alcoholism sometime tonight. Because I drank a little bit. These three guys were in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they were avid golfers, worse than I am, if that's what it can be. And they had gotten their act pretty well together, and their wives got together one day and thought that that they had really come along, you know, and really gotten their act together, so they were going to do something nice for them. They thought about it for a while, and they decided they'd come up with they'd take them on a trip to Hawaii. So they told them about it. They says, okay, we're going to take you on a trip to Hawaii because you've gotten your act pretty well together and you're living a pretty good life now, but absolutely no golf. Well, the guys, you know, that kind of set them off a little bit. They decided it was worth it, so they get over to Hawaii, and the first 3 days, ain't nothing but just window shopping and hiking and tromping the streets and sightseeing and all these things, and they saw all these beautiful golf courses and they couldn't play. And after about 3 days of this, they just gave it up. They said, okay, no matter what happens, what's the consequences, we're going to play golf tomorrow. And they said, we'll meet on the golf course, and they named the place. Be there at 9 o'clock in the morning. So they get out there on the first tee in the morning, and the first guy gets up on the first tee, and he's ready to tee off, and he says, boys, you don't know what this is costing. They says, why, what happened? He says, well, when I told her I was going golfing this morning, she said, if you do, I'm having that $1,500 ring that we saw yesterday. He says, oh, okay. So the second guy gets up on the tee, and he said it cost me a little more than that, and they said, what happened? He said, well, when I told her I was going golfing this morning, she says, if you do, I'm having that $3,000 painting. Yeah. Okay. Third one gets up, and he ain't said nothing. He's ready to tee off, and they says, well, what's it costing you? And he says, nothing. And they says, what happened? He says, well, when I woke up this morning, I nudged her and I said, golf course or intercourse? And she just rolled over and says, take your sweater, it might be cold out there. You know, I don't have much of an alcoholic story. I drank a lot of booze a long time, and it did to me what it does to practically everyone who suffers from the disease of alcoholism. And I didn't realize that didn't ever dawn on me that alcoholism was the basis of all of my problems. I just thought life was not good to me. My current wife is out here right here standing. Some of you know her. She's spoken here in this church a long time. I call her my current wife now because it keeps her on her toes. Now, you know, we recently, I think that our relationship is now the longest relationship that I've been able to maintain with any human being in my life. And I'm 67 years old. I've lived with this woman longer than I've stayed around any other human being in my whole lifetime. We recently passed a crossroads where the house that we live is the longest continuous one address that I've ever had in my life. I mean, these are milestones that have come to me as a result of this program by Alcoholics Anonymous. It's something that, you know, that I feel proud of a little bit. I just don't know of any other thing to say. You know, and there are a lot of people now and I noticed some of the newcomers that introduced themselves as alcoholics and drug addicts. This program is 12 steps, called 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, were introduced by Bill W. 58 years ago or 59 years ago. And they've come to be used by a lot of different groups all over the country. I've heard the numbers, some 300 different people have adopted the 12-step program that was conceived in that book of Alcoholics Anonymous back in the late 30s. And it's great. I mean, I have no objection to that. We have, as our program of Alcoholics Anonymous stated, that we have but one primary purpose, and that's to help the drunk that still has a need to drink, and we want to show him the way, that there's a way out of this thing. And that's why I'm here tonight. You know, I don't know that I can say anything to you that will lead you away from alcohol if you still have a tendency to want to drink. Somewhere down my story tonight, I'll tell you exactly what happened to me. It was just one of those things, you know. When I started drinking, I'm not one of those that can tell you exactly the moment or the exact age I was when I started drinking, but I assume it was around 7 or 8 or 9, somewhere in there. I can remember, I was born and raised as my childhood was spent on a farm in Iowa. And I can remember the harvest time, small grain harvesting, when they had threshing rings. And at the last home where they thrashed the small grain, at the end they always had a beer bus, and they'd get a lot of beer. And so I was designated cleanup. I was in charge of the cleanup, and me and my buddy, you know, would run around and clean up these empty bottles, and we discovered that a lot of them weren't completely empty, and if you poured a little bit out of one of them into another, you know, you'd get a couple, three bottles of beer, and we'd drink those and got awful high and funny and raised hell, and I liked the feeling. And I don't think I was alcoholic at that moment, but I can remember that every chance from there on, I drank when, like Don says, every chance I got, and I overdrank. I was hinted at being an alcoholic in high school, and I did well in school. God gave me talents that I am appreciative of today. And the comment was, Earl can't be an alcoholic because he's too smart. So I was too smart for 40 years to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was too smart to be an alcoholic. And it damn near killed me. Alcoholism has no respect for sex, age, intelligence, anything. If you drink to excess, anybody can be an alcoholic. I have my own personal views. You know, there's a passage in that book of Alcoholics Anonymous on page 45, the start of chapter 4. It says, lack of power was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously. Well, where were we to find that power? That's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself that will solve your problem. And that means we're going to talk about God. My theory is that, most drug abusers, most obsessed people, for some reason or other, have lost the concept of God. And that's what the 12 steps do. they enable, you know, you find the power. So I believe that's my theory. You know, I don't want to go too deeply into that because when you lose the concept of God, you become somewhat of an atheist. Now, I never was. It's been explained to me, I don't really know what an atheist is, and I don't know what an agnostic is, and I don't know what a believer is. But I've been told that there are three types of believers. There's one that believer, true believer is one that they claim to be able to prove there is a God. And the atheist is the group of people who claim to be able to prove there is no God. And then most of us, I think, are agnostics, and that's why the Book of Alcoholics Anonymous has a whole chapter entitled We Agnostics, just chapter 4 in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's somewhere in between. We're ignorant. And there ain't nobody more ignorant than I am. Particularly when it comes to talking about religion or God or theism or whatever. So anyway, I have a feeling that that's what happens to most people. We become so self-centered that that's all we think about is our own obsession. That was the way I was with alcohol. Whatever. And what I was going to tell you about those is we have all these kind of obsessions that I recently discovered a new one that I didn't really know it was around, but there's a group down and up in Bakersfield calls themselves Sexaholics Anonymous. My buddy was telling me this group called Sexaholics Anonymous, and I says, well, what are their symptoms? He says, I don't know, but he said, I met this one, and she was going to Alcoholics Anonymous, AA meetings, and he'd seen her around, you know, for a few weeks, and they recently were going to have elections of trusted servants, and he says, why don't you run to be secretary or treasurer or something, this group, or greeter or something? She says, well, I can't. She says, I'm not really one of you. He says, what do you mean? She says, well, I'm a member of a group called Sexaholics Anonymous. He says, I wish I'd have met you before you went into recovery. Sounds like an alcoholic to me. That's the kind of people I sponsor, by the way. You know, back when I was drinking, my very, very first drunk that I remember when I really, really got bombed was the 4th of July of 1940. And I was 13 years old. And I'd been out stalking small grain in the morning, and it was about 115 degrees in the shade. And my dad says, okay, we're going to knock it off at noon and take the afternoon off. It was the 4th of July. And in our little town in Iowa, they have a big to-do about the 4th of July celebration. They have a parade in the morning, and they have a street dance, and, you know, everybody for miles around comes down to a town of 1,000. They have about 5,000 to 6,000 people in town, or more even, I don't know. Parking is at a premium anywhere within the city limits. And I went to town and proceeded to get pleasingly drunk, sick like gone through you throw up, and I threw up all over myself. I came to about 4 o'clock in the park and continued to drink. I discovered at 13 that the hair of the dog that bit you is the only thing that'll make you well. So I drank some more, and at 9:30 I'm under the stage that they built down on Main Street for the 4th of July dance. Worse than I was at 4 o'clock when I woke up with puke all over me then, you know. And I still drank some more, and I don't remember much going home, but I remember the next day I was about as sick as any kid ever be. And that was my first introduction to really, really getting drunk. And that didn't deter me a bit, you know. All through high school, I was drunk. I stole my dad's car. I took some kids to a basketball game on a blizzard night in Iowa. I don't know how in the world we made it, except I think that one of my buddies actually drove the car home. I don't remember a whole lot about the trip. So I believe that David drove the car home. And that's the way I was. I lived my life that way for 40 years. I finally, you know, every time things would get rough, I'd run back to my daddy. My mother died when I was a baby. And I think one of my problems there was that when I asked my family what happened to my mother, the answer to me was, God took your mother. And I thought, I think what snapped in my head at that time was, uh-oh, if God would do that to me, I have no need of God. And so that's the way I lived. And I lived that way till I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. In the meantime, somewhere along the road, I found a young, naive Iowa girl and got married and had children. And all five of those kids are either neurotic, psychotic, or drunks, or a combination. My oldest child, my son, is still, I don't know whether he's still under federal probation, but he pulled 5-year federal probation for dealing in drugs. My baby daughter, I have a son and 4 daughters. My baby daughter is still practicing. I hope she becomes part of our group someday. So that's what happens. You see, that's the real thing. It's bad enough that we bring havoc on ourselves. But in every alcoholic, he touches from 3 to 17 or 18 other people. And that's what happened in my case. You know, I had no business raising 5 children. I had no business getting married. I like to say today, my wife and I not only shouldn't have never married, we never should have met. You know, I can remember when I got sober, I had teenage daughters who at that time had not been introduced too much to the drug world, but they were emotionally more mature at that point than I was. So it's an awesome thing. When my first wife and I got married, she was 17 and I was 27. I had gone home to my father one last time. And every time, you know, I'd always get drunk. And I was always drinking when I'd get there. And my dad would take me in and let me stay. And I think that this last time he kind of made it clear that I was not to come back. And I thought that was about the cruelest thing he had ever done because I was only 27 years old. Not old enough to be out on my own. But I met and found this little gal and we got married. And started having these children. After 5 of them, I discovered what it was. I don't know what I was, you know, you see I wear hearing aids. I must have been hard of hearing then because we'd go to bed and she'd say, you want to go to sleep or what? And I'd say, what? And we'd had those 5 kids, and as soon as we got married, I re-enlisted in the Air Force. So we were traveling all over the world with those kids. And I was in trouble. You know, in the military, when you get in trouble, in those days they didn't have alcoholism programs like they do today. When you would get in trouble with alcohol, they'd just ship you off somewhere else. And that's what happened to me. I traveled all over the country. And I finally ended up back in the SAC headquarters in Omaha, and I was coming up pretty close to 20 years, and I had not been to Southeast Asia. So up in personnel back there, when you get close to 20, when you get 18, it rings that they have these computers and everything that tells you how to do, you know. And so if you had 18 years and hadn't been to Southeast Asia, you're going to go. Well, some guy up in personnel told me that, and so I said, okay, when the price assignment comes up, well, let me know. And he called me in a couple of weeks, and he said, well, I got a real good assignment over in a 1974 film group in Thailand. Do you want to go to Thailand instead of Vietnam? And I said, sure. He says, well, I can't put you on it unless you volunteer. So I says, okay, what do I do? He says, come up to the office. So I went up to personnel and volunteered for Thailand. and I got the assignment. A lot of people didn't like it, but, you scratch somebody's back, and we happened to be drinking buddies over at the club, so I got assigned to Thailand. Well, I got back from Thailand, and my nice wife, who I wasn't too generous with while I was over there, I had made her out of a $300 allotment, but I spent way more than that on booze over in Thailand. I got back, and she called a little family conference. I was invited, but I didn't even say anything. And they made a decision that we're going to split the house. They got the inside, and I got the outside. So I ended up out in Vandenberg, California, Vandenberg Air Force Base, and they stayed in Omaha. And I thought that was great. Then I could drink without them being on my back all the time. So I pulled my time in Vandenberg, and at 20 years I got out. I retired. I had 20 years and 14 days, and I think they were getting pretty close to reading my pedigree, I had a couple of protectors. I had a major and a master sergeant in operations where I worked. They protected me from the old man. The old man didn't really know I was an alcoholic, but they did. But I had protection. And I think, when I review my 40 years of drinking, I had a lot of protection all down the line. God specifically was looking out for, and he watched out for drunks, Anyway, I was able to retire from the Air Force, and shortly thereafter I went to work for the post office. And my drinking was progressing, and it was getting bad. I couldn't get up. I couldn't drink all night and go to work anymore. I was getting too old for that. And I was getting suspended for AWOL. And it got to the point where I was AWOL again in November 19. Well, first of all, in the spring of 1975, I got a couple of DUIs right in a row, and I went to court, and somebody had mentioned to me the SMART program. Well, the SMART program in Santa Barbara County was the forerunner to what is now SB 38, Multiple Offender Drunk Driving Program in California. They said, well, get the SMART program, and I said, well, what's that? And they said, well, you can keep your driver's license, but you go to the school. So I talked to my attorney about it. He didn't know anything about it. And I talked to the judge about it. He didn't know anything about it. And when I finally went to court, I said, well, how about the SMART program? He said, well, that's all right with me if you want to go. So he dismissed me. And well, I finally discovered that I had to go enroll in that thing. And to enroll in the SMART program, I had to go over to Santa Maria and see a psychiatrist. And some of you may know what a psychiatrist is. We call them head doctors or shrinks or whatever. This gal asked me all kind of foolish questions. She says, did you hate your mother and father when you were a baby? I said, I suppose I did. I hated everybody else. She says, did you wet the bed when you was a kid? And I said, hell, I still do. And it must have been the right answers because I passed. Got to go to SMART program. 18 months and I couldn't wait. I was drinking all the way through it. But the day I remember the last time I had to go to a meeting over there to see that counselor, I had a case of beer in the back. And as soon as I came out, I was drinking beer all the way back to Lompoc. Anyway, I went to about 10 or 12 AA meetings, or 14, something like that, as part of that program. And I remember in the Alcoholics Anonymous program that there one guy said, it's the first drink that gets you drunk. And I thought, what a stupid statement. I never had one drink in my life. I couldn't prove he was right or wrong, but because I never did have one, but I thought, if that's all you people had to teach me, it was nothing. So I wouldn't listen. I wouldn't listen to anything. And that went on for a couple more years, and finally in November 1976, I was AWOL again. And I remember one little incident over, I got to tell you this story.
one little incident over in I was still in the Air Force. I had got taken off on early Friday afternoon, gone over to the Alana Club, or the Enfield Club, and started drinking. And I got pretty well oiled and decided, you know, how drunks you get brilliant ideas, you know. Says I ought to run up to San Jose to see my brother. I haven't seen him for a while. So I headed out of Vandenberg and up 101, and I get to Santa Maria, about 20 miles, and decided I needed another drink, so I stopped in the outpost and had a couple and clipped a car coming out of the parking lot of the outpost and headed on up 101. I got to Los Osos and the CHP hauled me over. They arrested me and hauled me in, and then they called the wrecker and pulled the car in. So the next morning I gave a hot check to get out of bail. I get out on bail. Gave another hot check to get my car from the wrecker and headed on up to San Jose to see my brother. And I was scheduled for a court appearance in San Luis Obispo in about 3 weeks. So I went over to the clothing sales store and bought a brand new uniform. And the day before I went to court, I got a new haircut and a new hat and put all my ribbons on. And I'm sitting up there in the courtroom in San Luis Obispo. And the judge walks in with a seeing eye dog. Oh, shit. I got the only blind judge on the West Coast. And, you know, God takes care of drunks. They already knew, you know, they had already been to the probation department. And the judge said, "Sergeant Lyle, just go downstairs. They're waiting. The probation officer's waiting for you down there." And the only thing I got out of it, no money. The only thing I had to do was write a letter to the court once a month for a year, 12 letters, saying that I was no longer in any trouble with alcohol. I was, but that's, you know, I hadn't been arrested or anything, so that. These, you know, this is just the way it was. Anyway, it got to the point in November of 1976. I was AWOL again. And on the day before Thanksgiving, 1976, I was in a bar in Lompoc, California, and I called the postmaster. And I said, "Perry, your job is interfering with my drinking. I'm going to have to resign." He said, "Earl, you're crazy." And I said, "No." I said, "You make out the resignation papers and I'll be down Friday to sign them." So Friday morning, I'm in the Lompoc City Jail again for another DUI. My son found out about it, and he got some people, a good friend of mine, bar owners, to loan him $1,000 and go down and pay my bail. Got me out on bail. And I went down and resigned from the post office. And I was going to run. And I talked to a lawyer. And he said, "No." He said, "Communications in this country is so up to date today that if you're arrested anywhere, they'll put a 45-day hold on you." He says, you don't have a chance. So I was sentenced to jail. I pulled 90 days in Santa Barbara County Jail. Except that my son also took liberty that I didn't know about to get me assigned as a trustee in Lompoc City Jail. And what I did was I filed for withdrawal of my retirement money out of OPM, Office of Personnel Management in Washington, and I made my son power of attorney. So I'm pulling 60 days in Lompoc City Jail. And I'm laying there in a bunk one day, you know, thinking that my job was gone, the family was gone, the money was gone, the car was gone, the house was gone, there's nothing left. And I found out that morning that my son had gotten my retirement money and blew it. And I looked up and said, "Why me, God?" And out of the loudspeaker, a voice said, "There's just something about you that pisses me off." And, you know, that was the way God and I got along in all my drinking days. About 2 weeks later, I was released from jail at midnight on St. Patty's Day in 1977, March 16th at midnight, actually the 17th of March, 1977. And I walked 60 feet out of that jail, cracked a half a gallon of bourbon, poured a glass full straight, and I was drunk before I was a mile away. I drank that way for two more weeks. I want you newcomers to listen to this. I'd gone to a bar on the 31st of March with my little retirement check, Air Force retirement check, and I drank all day. I got there about 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning, somewhere there. And by midnight, my money was gone. And sometime after midnight, probably around 12:30, 1 o'clock, I don't know the exact time, but a cop walked into that bar, and he knew me, and I knew him. And he knew that I wasn't supposed to be there. And I thought, uh-oh, I'm going to jail. And he did what he had to do in that bar that night and turned around and walked out. And I said the first sincere prayer that I have ever said in my life. And I said, God, do I have to live this way the rest of my life? And there wasn't no booming voice out of any loudspeaker, nothing. Just a sudden realization that God says no. I pushed a drink back on the bar and got up and walked out, and I haven't had a drink since. That was the 1st of April, 1977. You can figure out how long I've been sober. Part of the sentence that that judge sentenced me was to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went to my first meeting on East Ocean Avenue in the Offland Club in Lompoc, California, about 10 days later. I remember the very first day when I woke up on the 1st of April. I was living in a little shack in the backyard of my son's house. And I met Mark in the backyard that day, and I said, Mark, I was smiling. And he said, Dad, what's the matter with you? You look okay. And I said, Mark, I quit drinking. And he laughed right in my face. He said, Dad, you've said that 1,000 times. And here's what I told my son. I said, Mark, I'm 50 years old. I've drank for 50 years, and I'm not going to drink for 50 years, and if I get to be 100, I may drink again. And that was all. 10 or 12 days, I don't know. A few days later, on a Sunday morning, I went to my first AA meeting. And in that AA meeting, some guy said to me, Earl, if you don't take the first drink, you won't get drunk. Jesus Christ, what a revelation. Why didn't I think about that? See, what had been bugging me for years was, it's the first drink that gets you drunk. This guy said similar words, but he said, if you don't take the first drink, you won't get drunk. And I said, oh, wait. Maybe those goddamn people got something to say anyway. You know, and I started listening to a few things in Alcoholics Anonymous. Those old cliches, live and let live, one day at a time, by the grace of God. And I discovered that, you know, you don't have to drink. The problems still occur. I was telling somebody today, my thinking is still so rotten that I'm afraid there I shouldn't ever go there alone. But it isn't the thinking that hurts you, it's the actions. See, I no longer cheat and steal to the extent that I did when I was drinking. I can live with another person, another human being, on relatively cool. We haven't had a fight for about 4 days, 5 days now? And I know I haven't wet the bed for at least a week. You know, all these things have changed as a result of being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. See what you people have done to some guy? It's amazing. I got involved in this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Specifically involved in
in the hospital and institution portion of AA. I've been in a lot of jails. I've made a lot of cross-step calls. I've been to a lot of meetings with a lot of you people. And that's why it's over. The granddaddy of AA in Bakersfield, California, did not drink for 39 and a half years, and he stopped being involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he had to start drinking again. He drank for 6 months, and he didn't tell anybody about it for 2.5 years. And he got up in front of the podium down there at the Alano Club in Bakersfield one night and told a story about it. You see, we're very serious when we tell newcomers to stay involved in the program. To my knowledge, you've got to go to meetings for as long as there's meetings. There's an AA saying that originated way back in the 30s. Them that don't go to meetings don't get to hear what happens to them that don't go to meetings. It's that simple. I have come to believe that I'm sober by the grace of God. Involvement in a program called Alcoholics Anonymous. And the fact that I'm willing to do some of those things that I just hated to do. And so I keep doing that. Chuck Chamberlain says in his tapes, and Chuck to me was, did as much for Alcoholics Anonymous as Dr. Bob and Bill W. in my mind. Chuck had a lot of money. And he did a lot of things. He had this retreat down in Palo Mesa in 1975. And in that set of tapes in his book called A New Pair of Glasses, I recommend reading it because it's a wonderful name, or get the tapes called The Palo Mesa Retreat. Chuck says in there, and he goes through the steps pretty good, but he says in there one thing that really rings a bell with me. You can't think your way into proper living. You have to live your way into proper thinking. You see, my mind is still as screwed up as it ever been. But my actions are a far cry from what I was when I was drinking. See, I can still think all these dirty, rotten things, but I don't act on them. I pay my bills on time. Bill L. and I were talking a little bit tonight at supper, and I want to thank Bill for the supper. Well, it was a group paid for it. Bill did, but it doesn't matter. I got free supper out of it, so I'm grateful. It's one of the advantages he gets. We were talking about this monetary thing. You know, and I discovered that really the size of the wad of bills in your pocket doesn't have any bearing on the program of Alcoholics Anonymous whatsoever. I threatened to take bankruptcy in my first few months of sobriety because the only reason I didn't know you people then was I didn't know you. I owed everybody else in the world. So I thought. And I didn't think there was enough money in the world to pay it off. And I went to my then sponsor, and she's still somewhat of a sponsor of mine, but I don't see him very often. I have a sponsor in Bakersfield who's sober 40 years. But I said, Bob, I'm thinking, I says, the only way I can get rid of these debts is file bankruptcy. And Bob says, well, let me tell you something. He said, the thought came to my mind that that's the only way I could get out. And then he said, I thought again, and I decided I better pay him. And he said, this is what I did. And he showed me the list. And he had a list of 60 or 70 creditors in the tens of thousands of dollars. And he didn't make any money, hardly any money then. And he said, I decided not to pay bankruptcy because somebody recommended I don't. And he said, I'm still paying on some of them. He'd been sober 10 or 12, 14 years then. Now he says, don't just take my word for it. You go see Hank over there. So I went and talked to Hank. And Hank had declared bankruptcy. And Hank said, Earl, I wish to God I never had. So I had two people telling me,
don't do it. So I didn't declare bankruptcy. Of course, it helps if you marry a woman with money. I didn't know she had money when I married her, but I found out later. Yeah. I was very fortunate. I got 7 months sober. Somebody said to me, call the post office. They're hiring. And I called Santa Barbara, and they said, come on down. And I went to Santa Barbara, and they said, we got a job for you. Now, it wasn't much of a promise, because the job they had for me was a letter sorting machine, where it took eye-hand coordination to run that letter sorting machine. So I went in there one day and took an aptitude test, and before I started, the guy, the trainer, said, how old are you? And I said, 50. He said, nobody has ever passed this test who is over 45. I said, thanks a lot. But I sat down and took the aptitude test, and he said, you passed. So they put me on training, and there were 11 lessons. And the manager who was in charge of training told me, he says, Earl, I'll make a deal with you. You got 47 hours to go with 11 lessons. He says, if you do the first five in under 25 hours, you're hired. On the day before Thanksgiving of 1977, I passed lesson five after 19 hours. 2 days later, I was hired back in the post office. And from then on, it was a pretty well uphill grade. You know, I was able to pay off those bills. We moved to Bakersfield about 13 years, 12 and a half years ago. And we own our own home. There's a passage in that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. For those of you who still worry about the material well-being, it says, for us, material well-being always follows spiritual progress. It never precedes it. So if you get hung up on the material well-being, take a look at your program. Get involved in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And maybe material well-being will materialize. For some, it never does. Bill Wilson says this. I was very fortunate. I'm going to Hawaii Tuesday, by the way. My wife bought us a stay in a resort over in Kona, Hawaii, and I'm going over and play Mauna Kea Resort, I hope. Now, 15, 16 years ago, I would never have dreamed that I'd be flying to Hawaii to play golf or just camp out in a resort. Because it just doesn't happen. Not in a position when I was just walked out of jail with nothing. But it's going to happen because I'm flying to Hawaii Tuesday. There's another passage in that book that I want to touch on a little bit. Many of you know that the promises appear on page 83 and 84 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the third edition. Now, when I talk about the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I prefer to talk about and specify the third edition, because the first and second edition are not exactly the same as the third edition, and that's what most of us look at today. But at the bottom of page 30 or 84, just before it starts step 10, at the end of step 9, there's one little sentence in there that I think sums up our program as good as I can say it. Love and tolerance of others is our code. Now, I'm going to tell you tonight, and every meeting I go to, but I tend to, one of the things I intend to say at every AA meeting I go to is, when I quit, I say, I love you all. When I started saying that, it was pretty hard to spit out. But I discovered that for me, I better love every human being on earth. Because if I don't, then I put myself back in a position that's higher than God. And I did that for too long in my life. We talk about equality in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And to me, God made us all equal. if one of us, if one of us is a child of God, we all are. If one of us is not a child of God, then none of us are. So just remember that we don't judge people in this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. The most sincere thing that you can ever do, and the most sincere love of I've ever seen in my life, is one drunk talking to another with no expectation of anything in return. They don't even have to stay sober. You just say, this thing will work if you want it. Give it a shot. It may be the best chance you ever had in your life to become a human being. And I'm glad that I was able to do that. I'm glad today that I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and Bill L. called me up here to speak tonight. I love all of you. Thank you for having me.